Welcome to the Midlife Athlete Podcast, and I'm one of your hosts, Jason, and joined as usual by the other host, Greg.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. Happy New Year to you, Greg.
Happy New Year. It's the 1st of January.
I know.
And I'm feeling smug. I was on the turbo trainer today.
Oh, very good. I've had a day off today. Rest day.
I thought I'd just better get it in. I thought I need to start as I mean to go on.
And yeah. Did you just do a zone 2 session on the turbo?
Didn't actually. I only had half an hour, and I thought I haven't done a higher intensity. I didn't do a high intensity one. I did a higher intensity for half an hour, and it was quite interesting. I did about 10 miles in 30 minutes. And so definitely heart rate was higher, but it was right on the cusp of my top of my zone one, that zone 1, 2, and 3, which Phil Cavell talked about in his midlife cyclist. So that's 80% of my maximum heart rate, which was about 143, 144. I sat there comfortably for a half hour. And came off it feeling not too bad. And I could have carried on at that pace quite comfortably. And I know that when I've done 20 miles, or tried to average 20 miles an hour for an hour previously, I've actually it's really been a bit of a struggle. I haven't done that much cycling or higher intensity cycling for a long time. So that initial trying to get my legs going, they didn't quite respond. That what we were talking about in the first podcast about the neural adaptations, but you've got to learn to be able to switch these things on. So when you go for that sort of long, slow ride, and suddenly you hit a hill, you need to explode and accelerate. You need to be able to tap into those the type twos when you need to. And if you don't train them, particularly as we get older, we're going to lose them. But if we don't keep using them and learning how to recruit them or recruit them more efficiently, you're just going to feel a bit sluggish. Mm. Actually, by the end of it, because I wasn't absolutely going balls out as I used to do, this was actually quite enjoyable. I quite liked it. And I do realise why the high intensity can be quite a sexy workout, because you feel like you've done something, you know. Whereas, you know, what Stephen Seeley was saying about those zone ones and the low end zone twos is that you need to come off and think, well, I can't remember, it doesn't feel like I've done anything. So the sexiness is that, oh yeah, I've worked hard, my legs feel a bit sore, running up the stairs, oh, there's a bit, oh yeah, okay, I've done something to my body, I've done something which feels tangible. Whereas those long, slow rides can be a bit sort of, oh, what's it doing really? But the science is saying it's doing quite a lot because it's all in the background. You just don't really know it's there. So that was quite an interesting little journey there. So that was quite good. It's quite good.
And talking about go on.
No. So I was going to ask, what are your plans for this year? Have you got you're going to go off to Belgium somewhere and do some cobbles, weren't you?
Well, hopefully twice. So I'm doing the Tour of Flanders, but I'm going to bike pack over. Right. So ride over, do the Tour of Flanders, and then ride back.
Okay.
The only bit that I won't be riding is from London down to Dover, because of. It's just time wise of being able to take time off work and juggle it. Yeah. But I'll certainly be riding from from Calais to, I think it starts and finishes in, Oudenaarde, the Sportief. I'll be riding close to Oudenaarde and then obviously doing the Tour of Flanders and which I think is about 145 kilometers, and then riding back. So that's one thing. I have come across something called the Flandrian Challenge, which is climbing all of the bergs within, I can't remember the time, but it's a period of time. But I think you can do it in something like 3 days of cycling. There are three relatively big days of cycling. I think that would be a really cool challenge.
Yeah.
Hopefully I can.
When's that going to be?
Don't know. Hopefully I can rope you into it. After your burpee world record. I mean, let's face it, you'll be sick of burpees, right? So I'm frigging, well, you might flick to cycling then.
I say, there'll be a bit of a Stockholm syndrome with my burpees. I'll miss them at some point.
Yeah.
But yeah, that sounds really good, actually.
It's quite an unusual challenge. And again, a bit like when we did the Mont Ventoux, it's not that many people have sort of. I've done it, so it's quite unusual. So those are the two mains. I'll be doing some guiding again this year. I promised that I would take my eldest Kai to South Wales for some cycling, some hills. Now he's getting into cycling in a big way. So those are the ones that are, you know, kind of inked in for next year or this year. This year, gosh, yeah,
news. Yeah,
it is this year. But yeah, so that's the challenges for me. And I think for both of those stuff, your stuff and mine, what we're going to talk about today is particularly relevant. Energy really systems, cool. Yeah. Energy.
I think we'll be using different energy systems.
Yes.
We're relying on different parts of those energy systems, at different times, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Two very different challenges.
Very much so. But I think it's a real nice follow-on from what we talked about in the last pod, which for listeners was all around the muscles and you know what they are and how they work and so on. Because at the end of the day, you've got to fuel those muscles, right, to get them to do stuff that you want them to do. So that's what we're going to talk about today. And really, it's actually quite simple. It's complicated, but simple.
Yeah,
I think is probably the best way to describe it. Because
well, I think once you begin to understand it,
yes,
then it begins to it comes at you in a more you can start to break it down into fundamentals. It's like when you look at some of the intricacies, nuances within a muscle itself. Once you begin to see that time again, you begin to register it and picture it. You can then understand it much better.
That's true, but I think for me, I think this is a fundamental thing. If you can understand the energy systems and the physiological processes that go on, the information that then allows you to take into your training and how you train, I think is critical.
Very valuable.
Yeah, it's incredibly valuable on so many levels in terms of where you train, where you put your zones, your training zones, not necessarily your heart rate, but your training zones, how you fuel for, you know, that longer endurance stuff, or even some of the, you know, your burpee challenge is essentially an endurance challenge, but there's going to be an awful lot of intensity involved in your stuff in short bursts. So, you know,
it's going to look like a sore, my heart rate's going to look like a sawtooth.
Yes.
For 24 hours. These huge, you know, big peaks, and then hopefully not very much in between. But yes, the challenges there are legion at the moment, having to get my head around all that. But anyway, I'm looking forward to because there's a lot of this that I sort of know from sort of in my reading and studying, but it hasn't really quite sunk in yet for me. So this is going to be quite an interesting one.
Well, I'll see what I can do to simplify it, Greg, for you. I mean, there are only three energy systems. So if you sort of thought of it like a triangle for the moment, right? Picture the triangle. The pointy bit of the triangle is the phosphagen system. It's the stuff that you'd utilize this system when you're doing.
Hang on a minute. Three pointy bits on a triangle.
They're what? There's only one point. Well, okay, the bit pointing upwards, right?
A pyramid.
Okay.
The apex.
Right. Okay, the apex of the system. So it's the phosphagen system, which is really for short bursts of, you know, so your 100-meter sprint, your Olympic weightlifter that you know we were talking about with the muscles before, And it basically breaks down a substance called ATP. People probably heard of creatine, and it's that explosive nature. You can only really do it for seconds, basically. You can't really go anything beyond that. You just can't sustain it. So we generally don't tend to go into that area and utilize that energy system, or very rarely. And the ATP and creatine is obviously within the muscles, right? So you're basically unlocking that as part of the process to be able to allow you the fuel to be able to do that explosive nature of it. Then the two others, as you come down that apex of that triangle, the sort of, if you think about the middle strata, it's the glycolytic system. So basically what you're doing is you're utilizing glucose as your main energy
resource. Glycolytic
system.
Yeah.
And you're utilizing glucose mainly for that. We would have probably all been spent time in that area. You probably would have spent time in that area on your 30-minute bike ride today on the turbo. And essentially what happens there is, the glycogen is stored within the muscles, carbohydrate is in there and in the liver. So we store a lot of carbohydrate in the liver, and that's an energy source that we draw on. And it utilizes that to be able to fuel the muscles. The next system, if you like, the one right at the base of that pyramid, is the oxidative system. And really what we're doing there is we're utilizing oxygen to break down fats and carbohydrates, which again are present, and that produces energy. And that's much more kind of low intensity stuff. So the stuff that we would be doing, walking, climbing the stairs, or very low intensity sort of form of exercise. So that's why you're going to utilize that system mostly, which is why I kind of refer to it as the kind of base of that pyramid.
Which is basically that's what you're doing when you're asleep. Your cells are operating 24/7, and so that is your energy source. You're just not using very much of it when you're at rest, and low intensity activity. Yeah.
Yeah. So what's what we're utilizing now, right? We take in oxygen. that oxygen gets carried around, gets around to the muscles. It breaks down the carbohydrate and fats in the muscles. And then it byproducts, obviously, are stuff like carbon dioxide, which obviously we breathe out. So that's why it's the oxidative system. I think that the important thing I should say, and actually Sinead, who we interviewed way, way, way back, you can't think of these systems in that pyramid. It's not like you're in one and then suddenly you leave one and go into another, right? They're not sort of firmly demarcated lines that you just, you leave one and go into the other. They sort of blur. So as you sort of move through that sort of oxidative system, if you're increasing the intensity of your exercise or whatever it is that you're doing, you're likely to draw on some of the other system. And likewise, if you did your bike session this morning and you decided to do some 20-second sprints or whatever, at the end of that session, you would have moved, right through the whole pyramid from start to finish at the end of that session. So they're not fixed zones in that sense. We kind of utilize them at the same time to a degree.
But I can check, because I think that there is a trend in the fitness world to try and put them into categories, into little pigeonholes. I remember talking to you on the pod a few years ago about some of the sports watches on the market, and particularly ones that I looked at in the shop, and they were clearly targeting women, and they had literally either fat burning or fitness. There was two zones effectively. That was their raison d'etre for this watch, and I looked at that and thought, God, he's so patronizing, but at the same time, so bloody wrong and misleading. I'm in my fat burning zone. I'm in my fitness zone. It's like, that doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of confusion.
Well, and the reason it doesn't work that way for listeners is, you know, these energy systems are interlinked with what production of lactate. Mm. And so, you know, particularly in the lactate is produced even in the oxidative zone. You produce lactate, and lactate's a kind of it's a bit of a kind of mystery what it is, but people would know of lactic acid, which is a byproduct, which you tend to get, you know, towards the end of sort of high intensity exercise, which means then it builds up and you find you can't go anymore. But lactate is energy. You can utilize that, and the body utilizes it as fuel again. So those three kind of energy systems, if you like, are all connected together by what's called the production of lactate and what's called a lactate curve. So when you're in that oxidative state, you are producing lactate, but it's minimal lactate. And what tends to happen at a cellular level is the cell, the mitochondria within that cell, can use that lactate as fuel. And so it's just circular and it stays within the cell.
Yeah.
At right. some point in time, if you increase the intensity, your lactate production tends to then increase. So, and it typically that's known as the first lactate threshold point. And that right. that will dictate, you know, that you're largely moving into the glycolytic system, and you know, you're producing more lactate, and that's still not a problem because the cell will utilize some of it in the mitochondria, but some of it then tips over into the bloodstream and it gets transported around for use elsewhere. It's called a lactate shuttle. Then obviously if you keep on increasing the intensity, that curve has started off flat, is now, you know, had gone past that first point of inflection, is now going to a second point of inflection where the lactate is, it just basically, your body can't utilize it quick enough. You're producing so much of it, it just cannot deal with the production of it. And so it can't clear it. And because it can't clear it, you then feel the effects of that as what people tend to know as lactic acid. And then we all know what happens, you kind of grind to a halt. So you've got this curve, and that effectively dictates, it goes, you know, so it's like, it acts like a thread across these zones. So when you talk about training zones, and reason why some of those watches are so rubbish is they can't actually determine your two lactate threshold points. The only real way you can determine that is actually if you take a lactate test, which, you know, is quite impractical when you're out and about on the bike or running or rowing or whatever it is that you're doing. But that's essentially how the systems work. They're all based on lactate, and either if you're really unfit, you'll find that very first point, that lactate threshold point, will actually be quite small. It won't take you very long to do much of an intensity to actually get to that point, and you start producing more lactate, which spills over into the bloodstream. Likewise, if you're a pro runner or endurance athlete, that point becomes way stretched out. And so that oxidative zone becomes much, much greater. That's that aerobic base that we talk about, or that aerobic engine. And that's how the energy systems work, really. It's complicated, the whole sort of each system, but if you sort of stand back, it's quite a simple process, really. And then from there, you can dictate your training zones once you understand, you know, physiologically what's happening and where your lactate is likely to be produced.
Okay, so where do we go from here in terms of then you think, okay, how do I determine my first lactate threshold?
Yeah, so that's...
And is that the same as the aerobic threshold?
Yes, yeah. So you would have... So there are two lactate points, two lactate thresholds,
yep.
LT1, LT2. That's typically how science journals and stuff will refer to them. What people might have also referred to them as the aerobic and anaerobic threshold.
Right. Yep.
Okay. So you'd have heard, I'm over my aerobic threshold, but I'm not you know, I'm going to ride or run up until my anaerobic threshold. So a lot of listeners, when they talk about threshold training, threshold intervals, that kind of stuff, it's that second anaerobic threshold that we're really kind of talking about. It's where you're really in that zone where you're utilizing some of your oxidative zone to get there, but you're burning carbohydrate, glucose, and you're just at that point where you haven't tipped over it, where your body just can't clear it. So it's still being able to clear it in the bloodstream. But again, you're only probably going to be able to sustain that for, you know, a certain period of time at that threshold point, maybe an hour and a half, and then the duration will flip you over the other side of that line. How do you determine your lactate threshold points or your aerobic and anaerobic threshold points? The ideal way is a test, a lactate test. It's the only real determinative way in which you're going to be able to do it. Now, as I say, that's quite impractical. So the only other ways that you can kind of do it, but it needs a kind of triangulation. So this is what I would do, for example, with my clients, is to say, well, we know roughly that the first lactate threshold point, so the end of your oxidative state, is roughly 70 to 75% of your maximum heart rate.
Okay.
So you could say, okay, I know what my maximum heart rate is, so I can do that calculation. And I know that 75% I'll take as my upper end, and that's my first lactate point. Now, again, as I say, you won't be able to definitively know it, but it gives you a rough indication. The other sort of rough rule of thumb that you can use is, can you carry on a conversation? Can you chat? You'll be a little bit breathy, you know, but you can still talk. If you can do that, again, chances are that you're probably still within that first lactate threshold point. If you can't, if you're, you know, you're really struggling to hold a conversation, you're just out of breath, you are probably in that second zone. So in your glycolytic zone, probably nudging up against your second lactate threshold point. So that's the rough way in which you can do it. So typically what I would do with a client, for example, is I would roughly, we would work out their maximum heart rate. But of course, that varies. So you can't say that's going to be the same all the time.
Would you do a proper stress test with them?
In an ideal world, what I tend to do is I've got a formula which I use. It's not 220 minus age, but there's a thing that I've got a code that I basically put in a bit of script that gives me a starting point. Then I tend to say, right, you've got to do a test. So it might be a bike test or a running test, or running intervals or whatever it might be. And then that gives you another triangulation point. And then I say, okay, I think, let's say 70% is, I don't know, 130 beats a minute, right? Go out and run or whatever it is that you do. For mine, it's going to be running or cycling. Can you hold a conversation? So get to 120 beats a minute. Can you hold a conversation comfortably? What's your RPE feel like? Or it feels easy, I can have a chat, fine. Okay. What about if you go up to 125? Oh, 125 now, I feel like that's... So then you can triangulate it that way. But as I say, without doing a lactate test, you're never going to be perfect. It's only going to give you a rough estimate.
Yeah. Okay.
But it's better than not being aware of it at all.
Yeah, and then with time you begin to play around with that, and you'll get a much better, more accurate take on it. You'll be able to sort of really pinpoint it with time and practice.
Yeah, yeah. And like you were talking about muscles and the neurological piece that you need to be able to do to activate and train the muscles, you can do the same with these zones. So these zones aren't fixed; they can shift sideways. And you can train them to shift by doing specific things. So if you take that very first oxidative zone, where, you know, as I say, you're producing a very, very, very small amount of lactate. If you keep exercising in that zone, because that zone largely depends about our mitochondrial function, because that's the thing that actually creates the energy for the muscles to operate in that energy zone. If you keep working in that zone, what happens is you produce more mitochondria, and the mitochondria also become more efficient. So you end up stretching that zone out over a period of time. And likewise, you can become, you know, you can push your second lactate threshold point out a little bit as well. So there's flex in these zones if you train them appropriately, just like you train the muscles from a neurological perspective. It's just that you're doing it from a physiological or a metabolic perspective, really, rather than a neurological one. And that's, you know, that's the real, I think the real key is if you can understand the zones and then understand how my training gets to not only use those zones, but can I manipulate them for my benefit for a particular, you know, outcome that you're trying to achieve, then you're more than halfway there in terms of figuring out your training, your exercise and your training associated with it.
So you're approximately where your lactate threshold one is, the aerobic threshold. So now you're moving up through the system, things are getting harder, getting a bit tougher, and you're approaching that LT2. What are we talking about there?
It's roughly sort of 80 to 85%, probably closer to 85%. So again, you'll have
So that's what Phil Cavell was talking about with his zones, with the heart rate, wasn't it? It was up to 80% for zone one. Zone two was 80 to 88%, and then above 88% was then your zone three. Which, and he said, just ones and threes. That's the polarized training. So ones and threes are where you want to stay. But so your lactate threshold is your zone. Is approximately 85 to 88%. Is that right?
I disagree with Phil a little bit in the sense that I would shift those figures down a bit. We're talking marginal stuff, but I wouldn't have said your first zone, the oxidative state. So that up to that lactate threshold one, I think that's probably closer to 75% than 80. Now, in a well trained athlete, maybe they could push it up to 80, but I think most of our listeners, for example, they may be at 70, because they've not trained that area. It's important to sort of to acknowledge that, and the reason I sort of refer to the triangle, I used it with a client running the other day. Think of a house. Instead of a triangle, right? The tiles on the roof is that phosphagen, you know, high intensity, you know, almost bursts of activity, right? Your sort of upstairs is your glycolic system. That's the main bulk of the house, you know, glycolytic system, sorry. Your foundations is your oxidative state.
Right.
And it's important that what people need to kind of realize is you can't train your oxidative state. You can't train that aerobic engine if you're playing around with the tiles on the roof. And that's what happens. So the stuff where you talk about your time crunch cyclists is a perfect example. High intensity exercise in short bursts of time will make you feel like you've made an awful lot of progress. The problem is, You're not operating in that oxidative zone, that energy zone at all. You're completely, in the other zones, and you're not building up that mitochondria element. So, from a long term perspective, yes, it gives you a short term boost, but it doesn't help you long term because you haven't developed the mitochondria function.
What I would argue is that you're not utilizing the oxidative state in the high intensity stuff. You are to a degree, just you're reliant much more reliant upon the glycolytic system, and therefore the oxidative state doesn't get as much of a look in. So yes, you are training it, but you're not training it as efficiently as if you were doing the polarized training, which is what
effectively, right? It's the effectiveness of that training. So yes, I mean, of course you'll pass through it because you're going to have to pass through it to get to that second zone, or even even that third zone. And so yes, you will exercise it, and it will be utilized as part of that stuff. But predominantly, you're at the other end of the scale, so you're not actually effectively developing that mitochondrial function that you need to really boost that oxidative zone that you're working in. And it's just not sustainable. That's the other thing. So long-term sustainability comes from developing that mitochondrial function. You know, one of the
this is what the pro cyclists do, and the runners do. It's just long slow runs or long slow rides. But you know, you can't do that exclusively, because then you don't have that power when you need it, and that explosiveness when you need it. So you need to do both, but the bias should be more towards the bottom end rather than the top end. Yeah. Which is what I was doing. I was doing the other way around.
And the other thing that, of course, what you are doing, why, you know, if you spend a significant period of time, and this is why pro athletes spend a huge amount of time in this oxidative energy zone, is and building that mitochondrial function and efficiency, is that means that you can clear lactate much more effectively.
Yes.
So one of the, you know, when people watch, you know, days of Chris Froome, now Pogacar, what they were seeing is, and Chris Froome in particular, because I think he actually went through a battery of tests, because there was an awful lot of fuss about whether he was doping and what have you, and he made himself available for a lot of lab tests. And what they found is he clears lactate. His efficiency in clearing lactate was incredible, which allowed him to then be able to go again. So he could do these bursts on climbs, and people were like, well, he must be on drugs. No. He had just trained in that physiological energy zone to increase his mitochondrial efficiency, which meant that he could actually clear lactate more effectively than you know, some other riders. Some of that was obviously genetics as well. So plays a part. But you also see, you know, the lactate production, and this is why I think it really all comes down to that lactate curve as the thread between it. You know, if you diabetic patients, for example, they tend to produce high levels of lactate even in the oxidative, what should be the oxidative state. So you see it also with long COVID. Long COVID tends to attack that autonomic mitochondrial function. And so if you were to do a lactate test of somebody in a long COVID state, they were probably producing quite a lot of lactate, even just sitting around, which is why they complain, they fatigue, they don't have any energy to be able to do anything.
Yeah. That makes sense.
So it's quite interesting. So that's essentially the energy systems, Greg. It's you know, those three systems, and they're all threaded together by that lactate curve.
Okay, so then it really becomes down to how we train them.
Absolutely. And you know, I think in the next pod, what we can do is go into each of those bits.
Yeah. Okay, that sounds really good. Okay, well, that's slightly clearer now in my head, so thanks for that.
That's what we're trying to do, right?
That's what we're trying to do, isn't it? Very good. So are we going to do that first, or are we going to do strength training first? What's the plan?
That's a good question. What should we do?
Well, we'll work it out. I'm sure
we'll work it out. But I think what we can do is we can couple together aerobic and the more kind of anaerobic VO2 high intensity stuff, because now we've talked about the energy systems, it's just easy to map both of those onto that sort of framework, as it were. So we can definitely lump those two together. And then, we can then cover strength as a separate topic. There's some really interesting stuff I've been reading with strength stuff about actually how it does an awful lot more for you than we probably think. That the connections to brain health is quite important.
Yeah, it's as we dig into it, I mean, things become more and more fascinating. And you know, certainly as I'm doing more strength training, more weight training, I'm beginning to sort of fall back in love with it. And again, it goes back to what I said in the last pod about when I was younger, I just went and did it because I needed it. Well, I thought I needed it for rugby, so I was trying to get strong for rugby. But now I'm actually doing it with a lot more thought and awareness. And I find myself getting more out of it. And so I find it really quite, it's a challenge, but at the same time, it's quite good. It's a lovely feeling when you get it right. It feels very natural. You're thinking about it, but at the same time, you can feel your body moving in a much more efficient way. And it's actually quite a nice feel. Like on the bike today, the stuff I've been doing, the low intensity cycling, suddenly I'm spinning at sort of 95, cadence of 95, and I felt quite balanced, and I could feel my brain could keep up with that, and I could feel what was going on, and I felt the power was delivered more equally. So it's been I'm sort of relishing exercise at the moment, and for that reason, really, just because I'm sort of thinking about it more.
Yeah, and I think the same is true with these energy systems. If you understand the energy systems, and one of the things that I try and encourage any clients that I coach, you don't underestimate the RPE element to it, you know, which is basically our perceived rate of exertion, right? It's actually pretty accurate. You can almost feel when you're changing from one predominantly more into the other, because there's a trigger, there's sort of hormonal changes happen. So the autonomic system kicks in a little bit, and it releases hormones to enable you to unlock the glucose and carbohydrates within the muscles. So if you're moving from that oxidative state, and you can feel that. It's something that you can actually feel. And likewise, when you do those sprints or that very high intensity interval training stuff, you know, where you're doing absolute balls out 30 second sprints, you feel that build up. You can feel that lactate not clearing through your system. It's something you can, it's almost a tangible thing.
Yeah.
It comes back to, you know, some of the points you were making about the strength stuff and the neurological connections, starting to feel that and activate it.
Don't just go through the motions of it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
It is easy to just get on a bike and ride. And that's lovely. But if you want to get better at it, you need to think about it. And that's, you know, it's not just being given to you. It's you've got to tune it and work it and it's a skill. It is a skill. It sounds a bit weird to say a skill. You know, we can run, of course you can, but tuning it and making it work better, fine tuning it requires practice and thought, and I find the whole thing quite fascinating. Both professionally and personally.
Yeah, yeah. And particularly from, I think, an endurance perspective, because if you're looking to go further, if you don't understand the energy systems, it's a real impairment to being able to go further comfortably and enjoyably and in a sustained way.
Yeah. And then you can make a reasoned decision or decisions based on knowledge around fueling and nutrition, and you'll start your choices on diet can be affected by that. Not by saying I'm going to follow this this particular thing. I'm going to choose these foods for this reason. I'm going to fuel it this like this because of for the stuff that I do know what's happening in my body.
Well, yeah. If you take a very simple, practical example of how this plays out, understanding the energy systems, and I'll use cycling because I tend to cycle further than I run in terms of duration of time. But I can go out on a cycle ride, and if I think, okay, I'm going to stay within that oxidative zone, I understand that the energy that's fueling my muscle activity for that, let's say it's an hour and a half, I don't need to eat anything if I'm just going out for an hour and a half, because I know that it's all there already within my body, the fats and carbohydrates, and it's just a case of unlocking them by staying in that oxidative state. So I don't need to eat or drink. Now, if I think, actually, I'm going to be going out for 3 hours, yes, I could probably sustain that for 3 hours, but the likelihood is I may start drifting into the carbohydrate zone. So I'm going to be, but maybe not too much, but I'm probably going to stray over that line, right? So I'm going to be then utilizing carbohydrates. So then I think, okay, well, again, I could carry on probably for a little bit because I've got carbohydrates in my liver and I know I had a big pasta meal the night before or whatever it might be. And I could utilize that to a certain degree. But at some point, I will have run out of those reserves. So therefore, I need to eat. So then immediately you start saying, okay, well, now I can understand the nutritional elements of how I'm going to feed whilst I'm doing that ride. And same for a marathon, if you're going to be running for, 4 hours or 5 hours plus for an ultra marathon, understanding those energy systems and how your body is utilizing those and where you are within them has massive, massive repercussions for how you then fuel for it. So you get to the end of whatever it is that you've done, and actually you're not underfueled. You've performed to your maximum for however long you needed to. So it's
very good.
So that's the energy systems done. So we'll pick up on either strength or aerobic and anaerobic, some stuff in the next session. And as ever, we will release the stuff on Substack. The detailed notes, if you want to access those as well. And I appreciate you can't see things like lactate curves, but we can put them in the notes so you can actually see them and be able to utilize it.
Fantastic.
Thanks.
Well, thanks for that, Jace.
It's all right, Greg. Pleasure. Thanks for listening, everyone, and see you all soon.
See you.